Hello and welcome to our University of Strathclyde podcast series, run out of the world-famous School of Education, right in the heart of the beautiful city of Glasgow in Scotland. We bring you a mix of meeting academic interviews, thought pieces, conversations and provocations on all things education, to give you a glimpse into our world-leading education research here at Strathclyde, and of course to stimulate your questions and thinking around the meaning, purpose and practice of education. In schools, in communities, and of course in all our lives.
Hello and welcome to the next edition of the School of Education podcast. Today I'm joined by Sharon Hunter and David Kirk, who are the co-chairs of the School of Education's Ethics Committee. And today we're going to be talking about Martin Hammersley's 2009 article, Against the Ethicists on the Evils of Ethical Regulation. So we'll talk about that for the next 20 minutes to 30 minutes, and hopefully people will find something interesting arising from this to prompt their own thinking or their own practice. So Sharon.
Well, thanks. I just wanted to start by saying I was really very surprised that David gave me this article to read. It was actually just about our first interaction after I joined him as co-chair of the Ethics Committee, that he gives me an article to read on the ethics of ethical regulation. And I was a wee bit taken aback by that. Thoroughly enjoyed the article, but I just wondered if I could start by asking a question I've not asked yet, which is, why did you do that, David?
Yeah, it's a good question, Sharon. Well, I came across this and I can't even remember where I found it, but I just came across it. And the title is eye-catching, you have to admit. Mm-hmm. The evils of ethical regulation, you know. So, and Martin Hammersley is known for being somewhat provocative in some of his writing. So I thought, once I'd read it, I thought, this would be really interesting to get, well, at least the members of the Ethics Committee to read and then maybe have some discussion about. But I think more generally, I think it would be good for everybody who's doing research and everybody who's, or any other kind of projects where there are ethical dimensions. So thought-provoking. And what struck me too about it was that, as Claire said, it was published in 2009. So we could probably guess it was written around 2007, 2008. So what we're getting here is a window on another era. It's almost like an era where ethics wasn't a big deal in universities for sure. And certainly I can say, when I did my PhD back in the early mid 80s, there were no ethics committees. There was no ethical regulation. It was a different world completely. So that was really why I thought it was worth a read. Right.
So just a wee glimpse of what could have been.
In a sense, what was. But I also think some of his predictions are interesting too. How about you? Was there anything that struck you about the article, Sharon?
Well, there's so much to talk about here, and Claire, I know, is going to be quite strict by turning us off in 20 minutes or so. So I think there were two big things that stood out for me. They weren't necessarily the biggest points he was making, but I think they were the things that struck me. One was on page 219, where he talks about informed consent procedures and where they're hard or impossible to apply. And he says, this is likely to make research on both powerful and marginalised groups more difficult, if not impossible to carry out. And that was a big red flag for me. And I thought, yes, of course, because the people who, you know, the youngest children, people who can't communicate because of disability or language or anything, whatever, there is no power, the consent's almost impossible. And also where there is the greatest power, consent is almost impossible to obtain. And as a school that has, makes a very strong claim to have a commitment to social justice, then obviously as a people who are versed in critical theory, questions of power are really important. And if we're barred from collecting information where power resides or where it is completely absent, then that strikes me as a very serious ethical issue. So I think that was the first thing that really hit me in the article.
Yeah, it would be very hard to imagine getting ethical approval to interview John Swinney without John Swinney being somehow identifiable, you know. So there are people like that, given Scotland is such a small country, and it would be, so you can imagine that, how could you do some research with figures like that? Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's something that has come up recently in conversation with colleagues who are interested in the policymaking community, in a particular committee that's been set up recently to understand the composition of the committee, the criteria used to select and invite people, and the workings of the committee. And they're really fankling their brains to see how can we get in here without going covert. We can't, you know, that's not ethically acceptable for covert observations to be made, but how can we gain permission to have access to this information, which seems to be really important?
I think, though, even if you do get permission, and the understanding that they're probably identifiable, I think as soon as they become identifiable, the problem then is how much they're willing to share or how much they're able to share. So it's not just necessarily access and permission and anonymity, it's the authenticity, if you like, of the data that you collect, because it's you're in a particular role and you're not able to say certain things freely, perhaps. And I think there's the other side of it is the kind of marginalised groups. Mm. So we have gatekeepers are able to, you know, we might not be able to access parents for one reason or another. And, you know, head teachers can act as gatekeepers. And that can be for better or for ill as well. So it makes it problematic as well.
And not just head teachers.
No.
I think you've had experience of this, David, with looking for local authority permissions.
Yes, indeed.
And that was quite an interesting one. I don't know if you feel happy to talk about that one.
Well, without maybe identifying the local authority, but we wanted to, it was a PhD student's project, and we wanted to film some physical education lessons taking place. And what we wanted to do was to collect data on what the teachers said and did. We were interested in using self-determination theory around needs thwarting and needs supportive behaviour. Now, obviously, you need the children there because it's not a lesson unless they are. Mm-hmm. But we were absolutely forbidden from doing this because we were filming children. And filming children in PE kit and, moving and so on. And really, you start to think, what kind of assumptions are you making? Mm-hmm. About what we might do with this or what might happen to it if we were not careful about the storage of it. Mm. We eventually did find some sensible local authorities who gave us permission, but only on the basis that we did not generate any data from the children. And effectively, in research terms, they were invisible. Mm.
So, and that's an ethical problem in itself, that the children are invisible.
Yeah.
But it's this presumption of ill intent which makes this area of human activity regulated in a way that, and I think Hammersley brings that out really strongly, doesn't he? It's regulated in a way that no other area of human activity is.
Yeah, that's the showstopper on page 217. When I got to that paragraph, against this background, it's striking that the regulation exercised by ethics committees is of a much stronger form even than that of the criminal and civil law. And you think, wow, that is a statement. And he makes the point that judgments aren't even made post facto, they're made prospectively. Mm-hmm. So in other words, the assumptions are made that you're up to no good, mm-hmm. inevitably, and we need to make sure that you are disabled from being able to do those things that you might have planned. Yeah.
It's an odd one, though, because when you think in the rest of life, if I, after we finished here, go and have a glass of wine, then I will not drive after that because that would be illegal. I do, however, have a car. So it's as though at the point where I'm pouring it into the glass, somebody's saying, I see you have a car. So we're going to stop you drinking that glass of wine. It's this assumption that somehow or other this is going to take a particular direction subsequently. And that wouldn't make sense. It's risible. But that seems to be, it does seem to be the way ethical regulation goes, which is what's the worst possible construction that could be put on this information gathering?
But it depends who it is that's gathering the information. So people like us, as academics in the university, find it particularly challenging. Doctoral students find it a step easier, but still challenging. Master's students, certainly in our own institution, don't find it as challenging because they're doing what's part of normal classroom activity. They're researching something that's normal classroom activity. So there must be something that's happening that when we as academics are doing the research, that suddenly becomes non-classroom activity. So I'm about to do something in a local authority, and I know I'm going to have to get permission from the university, but also from the local authority to gather data. But in effect, I am doing what the class teacher would be doing. But I am going to potentially hit the problem that David hit, and I'm not videoing because I've already hit this problem previously in another very similar project.
You know, but there's a context for this physical education situation at least, and if you think about there's a whole period we went through from the turn of the century when some researchers like Celia Breckenridge started to report on coach abuse of athletes. And there's been research done on that since that argued that there's a whole moral panic happened around this, that this was this presumption of guilt on the part of sports coaches and physical education teachers. I think that the researcher then becomes by extension part of that whole thing too. I remember when I was coaching rugby back at that time, all of a sudden we all had to get these sort of accreditation, you know, you had to have a clean record, and you had to have it was an actual physical certificate you had to be able to show before you were allowed near a rugby team, you know, to coach them. So I think that there are contexts outside, and this is probably the case for many other forms of educational research in other areas, that feed into this whole regulation process.
And it's interesting to compare us to researchers in other fields. And I think Hammersley makes the entirely valid point that there is a very, very low risk of harm in this area of investigation compared to medical sciences, for instance, which clearly carry very serious risks. The risks that we pose are very trivial, arguably. And yet the same level of scrutiny is applied to this level of work. It seems out of proportion.
Yeah, he makes the point that at that time, what was being reported was that social science research had no major problems with big ethical issues like deception, fraud, and you know, harassment, and so on and so forth. And so he was asking the question, so what's, if there's no problem, why are we trying to fix it with these procedures? But we might ask the question now, has it changed? Has the situation changed? I mean, this is a good, probably over a decade and a bit ago. So we need to ask ourselves, what's different now from what was happening back at that point in time?
Yeah, I mean, certainly our conception of harm has been developing since John Stuart Mill, and harm used to be physical harm, and then my understanding of it is with the advent of psychology at the end of the 19th century, that conception of harm started to go beyond the physical. But now harm includes offence and other amorphous responses to what people say and do. So perhaps we're becoming more sensitive or more sensitized to the idea of harm.
Yeah, and some people would argue this is a good thing, that these procedures are necessary, because this is quite complex. It is at one level, you could argue that moving a researcher going into a school or some other research site is, in a sense, an intrusion. Whether it's warranted or not, then, you know, is the question that you need to be able to answer. Well, I was just going to start, sort of, no, you go ahead. I was going to move on to something else.
And in the case of, not being able to go into a school because of this enhanced conception of harm, then we come back to that critical theoretical question of whose interests are being served. Yep. Is the harm caused by not knowing about this starting to outweigh the potential harm of these nefarious intentions that researchers have? I shouldn't make fun of it, because it is an effort to protect vulnerable people. But on the other hand, there's a risk benefit weigh-in that should be happening here, surely. And if we can't go into situations where people don't have a voice, are vulnerable, be it the very young or other groups, then surely that is a very serious critique of the system that we now have.
Well, yes, the system we now have, ethics committees in a relatively short space of time have become institutionalized features of universities and other organizations.
Only so far. Universities have ethics committees to look at research ethics. I mean, I'm always interested in how little they review other ethical behaviour within the institution.
No, yeah. Well, but yeah, for good.
Within an institution, let's say.
Yeah, for better or worse. I mean, again, you could be. So, well, I guess what it brings us to really is to ask the question of, well, what are the. Given Hammersley's arguments, and there's a lot more to the paper than what we've been talking about, things like the administrative burden of doing ethical reviews and so on. But I guess it brings us to the point of saying, okay, well, we do have a reality operating here, that the University of Strathclyde has a code of ethics that we must abide by. But of course, the code of ethics is open to interpretation. How should we be interpreting what the code says? What should be the proper limits of ethical regulation for an ethics committee, taking all of the arguments that Hammersley makes into account? And the interesting sort of point he reaches when so at one level, he argues that really what should be happening is that each researcher should be their own ethicist, in the sense that they should be capable of reflecting on ethical issues in relation to their research and making good judgments about when some things might not be appropriate and some things might be appropriate. And I think that's a worthy aspiration, that even within the framework of regulation that exists formally, that each researcher does have those capabilities, you know, is their own ethicist, just as they should be their own methodologist, you know. Capable of making sound judgments. On page 220, it's a kind of a letdown when we get to the bottom of the page, when he says, let me end by making clear I'm not denying that ethics committees could have a worthwhile role. And you suddenly feel quite deflated with this. Oh, well, is that all we get to? But what he suggests is actually quite useful, you know, that they're there to offer advice, provide a forum in which ethical principles and their application can be discussed, initiate discussion about problem cases. You know, that seems like a quite benign, helpful sort of thing that ethics committees can do. So it does raise questions for us in terms of our practice as a committee, but also as a school and as a university, and as an educational community more broadly, because I do think that one of the things that's happened is that some people have swallowed the whole thing about ethical regulation almost to a point that has become quite, punitive. That the assumptions are always that researchers are untrustworthy, that they must be regulated because, and they certainly can't do it for themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. So they do need people with a big stick waiting to monitor the reports and so on.
Yeah, and that really does then put members of the ethics committee in the position of, well, positioning themselves as experts in ethical behaviour, which Hammersley lays out pretty well how there are a number of quite divergent and completely coherent ethical positions that you can adopt. Mm. And the idea that I don't think you need to be able to talk in those terms about ethics in order, or morality for that matter, to make a fair judgment. But having some intellectual humility about how competent one is to determine the ethics of a situation, I think it's really important. And we don't want to position ethics committees as experts in that sense, while at the same time perhaps making ourselves more worthy of having those conversations with people.
I think I was going to make that point too around being experts in ethics. And I quite like the fact that Hammersley draws attention to the fact that usually they're ethical guidelines and not ethical regulations.
It's like in Pirates of the Caribbean, but they're not. It's not a rule; it's a guideline. You don't know the scene, okay? You can edit that one out, Claire.
Yes, I'm sure I've seen the scene, but I know the difference between a rule and a regulation and a guideline. And that idea of being your own ethicist is something that we should be monitoring in terms of our practice all the time. How we work with our colleagues, how we work with our students. It should be part of who we are as academics or practitioners or however we want to describe ourselves. Some of our colleagues belong to professional bodies, or our students belong to professional bodies, so they're already covered by those ethical considerations and those ethical guidelines that are stronger than guidelines, actually. Yes. If we look at professional standards. Yes. And the idea of monitoring is an interesting one. I think David talked about people monitoring their reports, or the ethics committee monitoring people's reports, but they don't monitor. They do exactly what we've been saying. They look at them in anticipation of the project, and then that's it, finished. Do you know? Nobody's checking whether I've done something unethical at the end, unless they get some kind of complaint.
Yes, exactly. Unless something goes wrong. And that's always the fallback position. What if somebody complains? What if somebody's upset? What if there's a challenge to what you're doing? You know.
Yeah. And the most cynical interpretation of this whole area of activity is that it's a huge administrative burden which is imposed on people to protect institutions from litigation. I'm not saying I believe that. I'm just saying it's a possible interpretation.
Well, no, but Hammersley, I think it's a fair one, because I think mm-hmm. Hammersley actually says that...
I just want to have a job, David. I just don't...
but he says, but you know, when universities have ethics committees, effectively what they're doing is they're saying that we now have responsibility for the research that's undertaken by our employees. In other words, it's not their fault. It's our fault, unless they haven't followed the procedures that we approved. You know, so that's the kind of get out. It's safety for institutions against litigation. I think that there's no question about that. And you only have to live in a litigious society like, say, United States to see how much sort of more regularly that happens. So you can see from a legal point of view why people get frightened by the possibilities that someone might take offence at something you've done.
In some ways, some of the systems provoke fear in participants. Hmm. So in our own institution, we've got a privacy statement that's meant to accompany information sheets. And if ever there was something that was going to panic a participant, it's reading the legalese in this privacy statement that is promising all sorts of non-harm and all the rest of it beyond the information sheet that they've already had. And then there's the risk form that we have to complete, and I'm sure is replicated in other institutions as well. So, you know, in some ways it's ramping up the idea that there may be some harm. Why are you telling me that this might not happen, or that this isn't likely to happen? It hadn't even entered my head as a participant that I might fall down the stairs on the way to the interview room, or that, you know, the drawing that I do in my jotter might suddenly appear in a tabloid newspaper, you know.
That kind of technical language of withdrawing consent instead of saying, if you change your mind, that's okay, which sounds a lot less scary than withdrawing consent, which sounds as though something really bad could happen at a moment's notice or with no notice at all, and you'd have to make a sudden decision to withdraw your consent, which is a very formal legal process by the sounds of it.
Yep. I think that as co-chairs, I think that what we're keen to do is to promote discussion, conversation around these issues. Not to say that Hammersley's right and what we're doing is wrong, and different time, different context. You know, a researcher in 2009 who would be well into his career, well established in his career. And very confident too in terms of his status, and that so he can say provocative things, you know, without necessarily any comeback on that. But yes, to have some open conversations about, okay, what can we reasonably do as an ethics committee while still abiding by the university's broad regulations around the code of practice? Accepting that educational research is, in most of its practice, is relatively uncontroversial ethically. If you go to the British Educational Research Association, for example, they have guidelines that they update on a regular basis, have been for the last, I don't know, decade or more. And there are accepted practices now, things that we would expect people to do just as a matter of course, that aren't particularly restrictive. But as Sharon was saying earlier on, I do think it's around the edges of this practice that things become highly problematic, to the point where, you know, is deception sometimes acceptable because it gets us closer to the truth than being open? Are people being silenced that we would want to hear from? So I think it's those kinds of issues that really we need to, these are problems that are worth discussing.
Yeah, and I think the one that I would add to that is something that I don't think was so prevalent when Hammersley was writing that piece, is around either practitioners or children and young people as co-researchers.
Yes, right.
Which is much more common practice now. And that becomes a challenge, particularly when we're taking children and young people particularly seriously, and we want them to shape the research that's been done and so on. And you don't know which direction they might want the research to go, but you still have to fill in an ethics application form before you get that. So you're anticipating all sorts of stuff that then it would render that research unethical, because you say you want to follow the children's lead, but you're not really, because you've got to fill in that application form first. So it's a whole other can of worms.
I suspect, Claire, we've used up our 30 minutes.
Probably. So, yeah, thank you very much. I think it's a fascinating topic, and I think it's one that hopefully people have got something from it that they can think about and perhaps feed into within our own school, but more widely from listening to the podcast. And hopefully within our own school, we can carry on these conversations informally and formally. So it's encouraging to me that we've got the two chairs of the Ethics Committee who are willing to engage in this kind of dialogue, and hopefully we can progress from there. So thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening in to our Strathclyde Education podcast series. We'll be back soon with another episode.